One of the things that you quickly notice as you go through my slides is that there's very little text. It's almost all pictures from a textbook. Pictures are really valuable for various reasons, but I intentionally leave the text out. It's not just laziness on my part. I intentionally keep the text out because I've seen this happen back when I didn't do this. If I have a bunch of text on a slide and I tell the class specifically, do not write this text down, that's a total waste of your time because you already have a copy of that slideshow on the site. So why would you rewrite it? That's like owning a book and then rewriting it so you can read it. Right? It's a total waste of your time. Not only that, it keeps you from listening to me, which is what I really want you to do. So by having mostly pictures, I kind of hopefully am forcing you to listen to me and put the information that I tell you into your own words in the notes. Which, by the way, you can do any way that works for you, but I really recommend, since you should be refining these notes later when you listen to recordings, I really recommend writing down the slide number in red, always in red in the up lower right. Draw a line in your notes every time I change the slide so you can know where you are. That way you can jump in a synchronized slideshow to a certain slide, refine that slide easily and quickly, not wasting your time. The first chapter is pretty general. It's an introductory chapter, as is this first slide, about biology, which of course is the study of life, study of living things. And so it makes sense to start the course with a little bit about what a living thing is. And this is something that we all kind of have a sense for from living ourselves. You know, it's pretty clear to most people whether something is a living thing or not. But it's not so easy to specifically define. It's not like a concise dictionary definition of what a living thing is or an organism. But speaking of living things, if you consider all of the material objects in the universe, there really are, in terms of life, there are three categories of objects, one of which is living things. Now, what are those two other categories? I'm talking about material things, real material things that exist now. Non-living is another one. That's two categories, living and non-living, which to a logician might seem like that's an exhaustive list, but it's not. There is a third category. What are you if you're not living and you're not non-living? Dead. Dead things is the third category. So the point here is that dead and non-living are not the same thing, right? A rock is non-living, for instance. It never has lived. A dead thing used to be alive, it no longer is. And so that leads to what it means to be alive. Why is a dead thing dead and a living thing living? Well, a dead thing is no longer conducting the set of chemical reactions that really are life. Life is a set of chemical reactions occurring in an organism. And that sum, the whole set of all the chemical reactions occurring within one organism, are collectively called metabolism. So life really is metabolism. A dead organism is no longer conducting those chemical reactions. That's why it's no longer alive. Now, organism and living thing are roughly the synonyms. They mean basically the same thing. But when I say organism, I'm putting a requirement on that category. There is a structural requirement for being an organism. Does anyone know what that is? Well, to use a timely example, since we're still in a pandemic, Is a virus an organism? Is it alive? About half of the people say yes. And unfortunately, I hear on TV all the time that, or on, in ads that, you know, like Lysol, for instance, whatever chemical will kill the virus or any viri, which is not true, because a virus is not alive and it's not an organism. It's a biotic entity, which means it is involved with living things, but it itself is not living. It has no metabolism. It's just a collection of molecules. What is it that a virus, besides what it lacks in terms of a process, is metabolism. Metabolism is a process. But what does it lack structurally that all organisms have to have in order to be an organism? If I say that in reverse, what does every organism have that no virus has? No? I'm talking about a structure. At least one cell. Yes. That's the structural minimum for being an organism. You have to have at least one cell. And so just on that basis, there are two kinds of organisms in the world. Unicellular organisms, all those that are made up of just one cell, that's the whole organism. And multicellular organisms that we're perfect examples of as animals. Animals and plants and fungi are, most fungi are multicellular organisms. Well, that doesn't make us more of an organism. It's one is enough to be an organism. One cell is enough. A virus, though, isn't close to having a cell. It's just, like I said, a small collection of molecules. It's way smaller than a cell and doesn't have the structural components that make up a cell. And that's why it can't have metabolism. A cell is not only the structural unit of life, but it's the functional unit of life as well, because you can't have metabolism without a cell. Cells act like tiny test tubes. Life, really, the process that we call life, is really just chemistry. Metabolism is the chemical reactions occurring in a living thing. And those chemical reactions have to take place in relative isolation from the surroundings. Just like when you want to have a chemical reaction occur in a chemistry laboratory, you make it happen in relative isolation from the surroundings in a little test tube. Right? That's what cells allow organisms to have happen. And the metabolism that I'm referring to occurs within the interior of the cells, however many cells are in that organism. Okay. Well, an organism is alive. What I was saying before is that we have a gut feeling for whether something is alive or not, but the definition is kind of tricky. So we usually don't give a sentence form of a definition. We just recognize that organisms share these seven major properties. And some of these major properties of living things also are shared by some non-living things. But non-living things won't have all seven of them. And let's just go around this clockwise, starting with response to the environment. You already know just from experience that organisms respond to their environment, right? You touch a hot stove, you pull away from it. This just a simple example. But no matter how structurally complex an organism is, it's true that they respond to the environment. So those unicellular organisms that I talked about, like a bacterium, for instance, they also respond to their environment. They will avoid a chemical or they'll be attracted to a chemical, just as an example. There has to be a response to the environment, because being alive means continuously exchanging materials and energy with the environment. We'll talk more about that later. Reproduction is second on the list here. These aren't in any order of importance. I just happen to start there. Reproduction, though, is an example of something that some non-living things do even though they're not alive, right? Like crystals, for instance, reproduce. They're not alive, though, so they don't have all seven of these. And reproduction occurs many different ways. That's not the focus right here, but living things have the capacity to reproduce. Whether they do or not, like I've chosen not to reproduce, that doesn't mean that I can't. It doesn't mean I'm not alive. It is interesting, by the way, that we have 11, humans have 11 organ systems, like circulatory and digestive and so on. The reproductive system is the only organ system whose primary function we can live without. But anyway, reproduction is a possibility for living things. Whether they do it or not depends. Growth and development is next. It's two things lumped into one, but it's really there's a distinction between the two. Growth, of course, means increase in size. Now you, all humans, everyone, one of us in this room, started out as a single cell, a zygote. And we can think of that as the beginning of our life as an individual. But really, we don't have, I mean, that's just an artificial beginning. Yes, we technically started out as a zygote in certain ways, but you as a collection of cells really are just the latest in an almost 4 billion year long continuation of cells creating new cells. You're just the tip of that in time, right? The point there is that the cells that make up you didn't just pop into existence. They came from pre-existing cells. And that is a major concept in biology called cell theory, or it's part of cell theory. One of the major things that cell theory says is that cells come from pre-existing cells. Now, we'll talk later about how the fact that that can't always have been true, right? The original cells did come from non-living things that weren't cells. But that was when Earth was an entirely different place. Totally different conditions. It's no longer true that cells just pop into existence. They have to come from cells that already exist. So that's why I say you're a continuation of your ancestors. It's just a continuation of producing new cells. But anyway, you started out as a zygote, an invisibly single cell. And you are now enormous compared to most things in the world, because most living things are bacteria. That's growth, of course. But also, you didn't just get bigger. You also developed along the way. So you're not... Well, you're a collection of cells. Does anyone have a feel for how many cells you are? An average human? Of course, it varies from person to person. But an average. Any idea how many cells make up your body? Well, those are all true. And depends on the coefficient you put in front of them. You can say tens, it's still true. But it's roughly 100 trillion. So a billion cells is not very much of you at all. And, you know, a drop of blood, for instance, about the size of an average pinhead, sewing pin, straight pin, contains millions of cells. 100 trillion in your body. For, as an average, tens of trillions. Well, they're not all just exact copies of that original zygote. We're not just a mass of zygotes. We're multicellular, but we have different kinds of cells performing different functions now. That's because we developed along the way, which is a specialization in function. Okay, energy processing. We're going to get deeply into this in the third unit, which will, if you are like all the other sections I've taught in this course, will probably be the low point. It'll be the lowest mean of the tests. And it goes down from the first to the third, and then it kind of goes back up. And I think that's because by the time you hit the third, that's where people realize it's mathematically impossible to pass. So the people who make it past the third tend to be the students who had higher scores. But anyway, that third test is all about energy processing, which all organisms do. We have to continuously process energy for various reasons to remain alive. And we'll get into the specifics of that later. Regulation refers to keeping things within tolerable limits, within limits that allow the organism to remain living. And this brings up the notion of homeostasis, which is a word that means staying the same. Stasis is the noun form of static. The adjective static means unchanging. It's the opposite of dynamic, which means changing. Well, homeostasis, meaning staying the same, is really not the truth. No organism ever stays the same. Organisms are dynamic by definition of living, and for other reasons as well. We never really are staying the same. But we use the word because we try to keep things within limits that would kill us if we got out of those limits. So homeostasis is the maintenance of a relatively stable internal environment in an organism. And I'll talk about the regulation aspect of maintaining that homeostasis later on. Next up is order. All organisms exhibit a high degree of order. Not necessarily not just in the overall view of the organism, nor even the view at all. We're very visually oriented animals, so we think in terms of viewing something, but there's all kinds of ways in which organisms are ordered, even at an individual cell level, a cell itself, whether it's one of your trillions of cells or whether it's the only cell that a unicellular organism has. There's a high degree of order in that cell itself compared to the randomness in the non-living world around it. But there are exceptions to that non-living randomness. Crystals that I used before as a reproduction example are also an example of something that's very highly ordered, even though they're non-living. Compared to living things, though, most of non-living world is not nearly as highly ordered. The last one on this list is evolutionary adaptation. Impossible to overstate the importance of this concept to biology and really to thought and science in general. But it's often misunderstood, so I want to talk about both of these terms. Evolution simply refers to change. And evolution is a major topic in Bio 182, if you go on to that. But we'll talk a little bit about it in here as well. In any case, evolution refers to change, or to evolve means to change. But it's not individuals that change. Evolution is change in populations over generations. And as you'll learn in 182, if you do go on, there's three major ways that that can happen. But there's only one way in which evolution occurs in such a way that the population gets better adapted to the surroundings than the previous generation was. And so that's adaptive evolution. Okay? And the mechanism for that is what Darwin is famous for. Everyone thinks that Darwin is famous for evolution. It's not what he's famous for. He's famous for coming up with an explanation for how evolution can occur in a way that actually increases how well adapted a population is to their surroundings. And that mechanism that he came up with, that explanation, which is how it does happen, is natural selection. That's what he's famous for, not evolution. Well, natural selection, you know, the phrase kind of implies that there is a conscious thing selecting certain things and selecting against other things. It's really not that. It's simply that every individual has a collection of traits, and we nowadays, since we know about DNA, like to say that DNA gives us our traits, or any organism its traits. That's not directly true. DNA doesn't directly give us our traits. It indirectly gives us our traits. And that's because what directly gives us our traits, or any organism, are the proteins that that organism is able to produce. So you think the way you do, you have your personality, you smell the way you do, you can do the things you're able to do because of the particular kinds of proteins that your body is able to produce. Your proteins directly give you your traits. But you're stuck with those traits, more or less, because even though there's no limit to the number of possible proteins that can be made, your body, or any individual's body, whether human or otherwise, can't make any protein unless it's told how to make it. It needs an instruction set for how to make it, and that's what DNA is. So DNA indirectly gives us our traits because it tells our cells how to make certain proteins, and you're not able to make any proteins that you don't have instructions for. That's why you don't have those other traits. All right? Well, each member of a population has a different set of traits, just like getting a different hand of cards dealt to them randomly, right? Some individuals will have a randomly given set of traits that actually makes things work well for their particular surroundings, their environment. Others, not so much. So all natural selection is the fact that individuals that have a good hand dealt to them, they make the kinds of proteins that allow them to live well in those surroundings, they will have a higher chance of living long enough to have a chance to reproduce. And since reproduction means passing on that their particular set of DNA to the next generation, that means their offspring will be able to make those same kinds of proteins as they did and should be also well off. Whereas the individuals that were dealt a worse hand won't have as high a fitness. They won't be as well adapted to their surroundings. And they likely will die before they can pass that particular set of DNA on. That means each successive generation, the population should get better and better adapted or fit to the environment. So it's not only evolution, it's adaptive evolution. And that happens because of natural selection. All right? Now, not all of these slides are going to take as long as this opening one, so don't think that's going to be true. Some of them will breeze through. By the way, it is not 16 until 6. It will be always, it looks like, since that clock hasn't moved. But don't be afraid to tell me that I've gone over the limit, or just get up and leave. Because I don't continuously look at my chronograph. All right, the next slide. When do we end? Quarter after? Yeah. Which is a quarter after? No problem. The second slide presents the hierarchy of biological organization. And by hierarchy, I'm talking about a nested arrangement of things. So one level will contain certain things below it, each of which will contain certain things below it, and so on. Kind of like how an outline is arranged. If you make an outline, that's a hierarchy as well. I'm going to go from small to big here rather than big to small. So I'm going to start with atoms. Now, all material things are made out of atoms, but they are not actually the smallest things, as we'll talk about in here even. Atoms are made up of even smaller things. So it's not that atoms is the lowest possible level of organization. It's just the lowest level that really makes sense within biology. If you go below that level, you're really in a different science. So we'll start with atoms. They are not alive individually, but all living things are made out of atoms. By the way, this hierarchy involves something that's important in biology called emergent properties. Now, to emerge means to come out. What it means that is as you go up in levels, in this hierarchy, each higher level has properties that the lower levels did not have, which will become evident, I think, as we go on. So atoms is a low level. Atoms of different kinds collect to form larger, more complex structures called molecules. That's another level. And so those molecules have properties that the atoms themselves do not have. That's an example of emergent properties. They're still not alive, molecules. Molecules of different kinds collect into more complex structures called organelles. Now, you can tell from looking at that word that organelle is an organ-like structure. It really means little organ. It's called little organ because organelles are like the organs within a cell. They are subcellular structures. We'll survey them later, things like mitochondria or chloroplasts. Anyway, they are smaller than a cell. So they're still not an organism, but they're parts of cells. And then organelles of various types that we'll study later collect into the next level, which are cells. Now we're finally to something that is officially alive. That's an emergent property. Being alive is true of the cell. It's not true of the atom, for instance. Now, we're going to go up a few more levels until we get to, as you see, organisms, but these next few levels are really only exist for multicellular organisms like we are. The vast majority of organisms alive now and that have ever lived are unicellular. And for those, the cell level and the organism level are the same thing. You see that? Because that's all they are as an organism, is one cell. But for multicellular organisms, cells of different types arrange themselves into more complex structures called tissues. It depends on what kind of organism you are as to what kinds of tissues there are, but for animals like us, there's four tissue types: epithelial, connective, nervous tissue, and muscular tissue. Plants have other kinds of tissues, but they're still tissues. Tissues of various kinds then collect into even more complex structures called organs. And these are two different things that are lumped together at two different levels. Organs is its own level. An organ is something like the eye or the skin or the liver. Collection of tissues that function for a specific set of purposes, right? Then different organs collect into a higher level called an organ system. These are the things I was mentioning before, like circulatory, reproductive, digestive system. Those are organ systems. So they're different organs, but they are cooperating in such a way as to perform some specific set of functions. Well, for humans, there are 11 organ systems. And if you count all of you, combine all of those together, you have the entire organism, which is the next level. That is one individual, one living individual. By the way, we've already gotten out of the realm of Bio 181. 181 is all about the cell and smaller. That's the big difference between 181 and 182. This is cell-level biology. 182 is all the bigger stuff. But I still want to go through the hierarchy while we're here. An organism is a single individual. Well, individuals of the same species form or live in a certain area, and that is a population. So the population is all the individuals of the same kind, same species, however it's defined. There's different ways of defining species. But that's a population. Within the same space as is occupied by a population, you also, though, have other species, right? So if you include all of the species, not just one species, then you have a community. It's the same space, but the community includes all of the organisms. A population includes just one species. So how is a community then different from the next level up, which is an ecosystem? Well, a community is really a set of populations, right? So you might want to extrapolate from that and say that an ecosystem is a group of communities, but that's wrong. It makes sense to think that you would to guess that, but it's actually wrong. Population, community, and ecosystem really are all the same space. A population is just the one species that you're interested in. The community is all the species. And the ecosystem, the same space, includes the community, which is all the living things, plus all the non-living things as well. So the water and the mountain, those are part of the ecosystem. They're not part of the community. You see the difference? All right. Then that leaves just one step up, which is the biosphere, the biosphere. There's one biosphere. And it's still correct to call it a sphere because it is shaped spherically, since this planet is spherical. Unlike the planet itself, though, which is a solid sphere, more or less, the biosphere is a hollow sphere with a thickness to its wall. The thickness changes as we discover more and more living things, but one edge of that thickness is how deep we can go below the surface, below sea level, and still find things that are alive, which we keep surprising ourselves with. We say, no, there's no way anything deeper than this is alive. We keep finding it. But that's the deepest part. And then however far we can go from sea level outward into the atmosphere and still find living things, that's the other edge of the thickness. And it's still spherical because we still only know about living things on Earth. Now, just for statistical reasons alone, it is almost certain that there's plenty of other life out there. But it's also almost certain that we're never going to come into contact with any of it because of the enormous distances between... Yes. And since it's not faith, but science, we can't say, yes, there definitely are things out there just for statistical reasons. You have to demonstrate it. Well, if we do ever discover something that is extraterrestrial and alive, then we'll have to expand the size of the biosphere, and it will really technically no longer be a sphere, but anyway, the biosphere grows with our knowledge. All right, now to three. So I'm almost done. Is that what we're saying? Okay. The photograph on slide three, the background here, represents an ecosystem. It doesn't matter at all which ecosystem. This is just an example. The point, though, of the slide is that for any given ecosystem, as we just described it, there is a difference with respect to energy and materials. Energy flows through an ecosystem. It enters it, it leaves it. Now, what leaves is not the same energy as that entered it, not in the same form. So energy comes in most cases it comes in as sunlight. It gets transferred and transformed within the ecosystem. Transform means turned into a different form of energy, like radiant energy, which is sunlight, gets captured by photosynthetic organisms and now is chemical energy of the molecules that the photosynthetic organisms make. That's a transformation. Transferring energy means moving it from one object to another, whether it's a living object or a non-living or a dead object. So energy bounces around and gets transformed, but then eventually leaves as heat, which isn't shown on this slide, but it is on the next. That's different from how materials operate. Materials, more or less, are confined to the ecosystem. Not perfectly. There are some materials that go from one ecosystem to another. But more or less, materials stay within the ecosystem and just continually get recycled within the ecosystem. So the material that you're made up of is not the same material that you'll be made up of tomorrow. You know, some of it used to be a rock. Tomorrow might be part of a plant, and just always moving around. But it doesn't flow through like energy does. It gets recycled within. And I guess I better stop there so we can enjoy the laboratory. Oh, no, you don't have to. My other section does. So I'll see you Wednesday, right? What are you going to do as you come through the door? Sign in, yes.